In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, did Shakespeare really write Shakespeare?
Now, the most famous doubter is Mark Twain. Mark Twain wrote an entire book on this subject. Is Shakespeare dead? And he recounted how when he was learning to be a pilot on the Mississippi River, that the master of the ship who was training him was a doubter of Shakespeare, and talked at him at length while they were on the river about what a phony Shakespeare of Stratford was.
This podcast is brought to you by Canada's decontamination specialists, Crime and Trauma Scene Cleaners. Crime and Trauma Scene Cleaners is committed to helping people when tragedy strikes. Their objective is to restore safety to an environment in the most professional and discreet manner possible. To contact Crime and Trauma Scene Cleaners, visit crimescenecleaners.ca. Call 1-866-724-0800, 1-866-724-0800, or email them at info@crimescenecleaners.ca.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
Greetings from southern Greece. Well, I just returned from the Messinian Bay Hotel just down the road, where the family and I enjoyed a wonderful afternoon swim, followed by a spectacular sunset. The staff there were even conducting samba lessons on the deck. The mighty Aphrodite unfortunately couldn't coax me out there. Lucky for her, well, she should know better. I was born with three left feet. In any event, On to our episode for today. The Shakespeare authorship question has been called the greatest literary mystery in the world. Is it possible the wrong man has been credited with the works of Shakespeare? If so, how would that impact our understanding of the plays and their historical context? My guest is among a growing community of experts who now believe that William Shakespeare was a nom de plume that concealed the identity of England's greatest poet and dramatist, and that continued to hide it from readers, playgoers, and scholars for hundreds of years. Ramon Jimenez is a longtime Shakespeare Oxford Society member and the author of several books, including his latest, Shakespeare's Apprenticeship, Identifying the Real Playwright's Earliest Works. Ramon Jimenez, welcome to Conspiracy Unlimited. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Delighted to be here.
Likewise, happy to have you. Now, when one is discussing the Shakespeare authorship question, I've always found it can be a little confusing as to who we're talking about. So, I mean, obviously we would refer to the William Shakespeare who lived at Stratford-upon-Avon as, you know, William Shakespeare from Stratford. But before we divulge, you know, who you believe the real author was, how do we refer then to the Shakespeare who actually wrote the plays and poems?
Well, I call that person Shakespeare, and the man in Stratford I call Shakespeare. That was the way his name was spelled on almost all the legal documents in his county, without the medial E.
Ah, Shakespeare. All right.
So I call him Shakespeare, and that's an easy way to distinguish between him and the author.
Excellent. All right. So what do we know about Shakespeare, who lived in Stratford?
Well, we have a number of legal records here and there, and some local records, but we know very little about him. The records, for instance, that might have been produced when he went to school don't exist, so we don't even know if he went to school. We have a christening record, a marriage record, various lawsuits, convictions in Stratford-on-Avon. And then in London, we have a reference to a Mr. Shakespeare who was staying at a home around 1604, staying at a home in London where there a quarrel developed among the family and a court case ensued. And he was called to testify, which he did. Actually, he said he didn't remember anything. But he was referred to as Mr. Shakespeare from Stratford, and he lived in this home. He apparently rented a room or something there in London. Also, there's some records in London where he's being chased by tax authorities. He's being billed, and he's moved, and they can't find him to pay his taxes. Otherwise, there's very little known about Shakespeare of Stratford. There are no written records of anything else about him. There are no mentions of him in letters or diaries. There is a single letter that apparently was written to him from Stratford while he was in London. It was from a fellow named Quiney in Stratford who asked him for a loan. But there was no answer to that. And there's even a question whether Shakespeare ever received it. So that's the story. There's a record of his death and his burial. There's no record of any mention of his death or any commemoration or any ceremony or any eulogy or any obituary, anything like that. So there's very little. We know very little about him.
Do we have a signature? Could he sign his own name?
Well, we have six signatures that are alleged to be by Shakespeare of Stratford. And three of them are on legal documents. A couple of them are on a mortgage document. And there are three others on his will. Other than those on his will, it's even questionable that the others are his. So it there are six alleged signatures, but they are all, they are spelled differently. They are not completed. The latter part of the Shakespeare name is an end signature, and they appear to be written by someone who was very unused to writing. Now, they say that he was ill when he signed his will, and that's the reason for that. But these same characteristics appear on the earlier signatures. So he was either ill most of his life, or he was simply not accustomed to writing.
And, you know, as we go on, it just seems like a complete slam dunk in terms of the authorship question, that he is not the author. However, let me just proceed a bit further. Did he not have children, and is it true that those children could not read or write?
It appears to be true, but he had two daughters, and they signed their names with X's, which is what people who did who couldn't write. Now, it's conceivable they might have been able to read, but not likely. Shakespeare's parents were also illiterate. So they're asking us to believe that the person who, the most skillful user of the English language, had illiterate parents and illiterate children.
Right, right. And an educational background that is shrouded in mystery.
That's right.
All right. So when did the works first attributed to Shakespeare, when did they first appear on the scene?
Well, in 1593, the poem Venus and Adonis was published, and a dedication was attached to that, and that dedication was signed William Shakespeare, and that was the first time the name appeared in print. And the following year, another narrative poem, Lucrece, was published with the same type of dedication and the same name under it, William Shakespeare. And later in the 1590s, 1598, 1599, individual quartos of plays began to appear with the name William Shakespeare on them. So that was the beginning of it.
And then kind of an anthology appeared years after Shakespeare's death.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
In 1623, a syndicate of publishers, four of them, brought out what we call the First Folio. And this was a collection of 36 Shakespeare plays. Half of them had never been published before. And this is the sort of the basis of the Shakespeare canon. Now, since then, scholars have added three or four plays to that canon that they think are by Shakespeare. But as I said, when Shakespeare, well, whoever he was when he died, half his plays had not even been printed. Of course, that was common at that time. Most plays were not printed.
Right, right. And so the folio came out, the First Folio, how long after Shakespeare's death?
Let's see, seven years. He died in 1616, came out 1623. There were three subsequent folios, 1632, 1660-something, and so on. There were four of them altogether. And they were a little different.
Okay. Do we have any of the original transcripts?
We have only printed editions of Shakespeare's plays. We have no manuscripts.
Nothing in his own hand.
No. In fact, there are very few manuscripts have survived from Elizabeth's reign.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So here we have Shakespeare from Stratford. When he dies, there's no real mention of his death. The greatest writer that Britain had produced. Nothing commemorating his death. No mention of a grand funeral.
No, nothing. And we might add, 2 years later, John Fletcher, a playwright, died, and there was great mourning and ceremony. And also when the actor can't think of his name at the moment, Richard Burbage, well-known actor, when he died a couple years after Shakespeare, another great funeral ceremony, and London was drowned in gloom, they say. So there were people knew about playwrights and about actors, but Shakespeare aroused no one's attention when he died.
Right. And whoever the real author was, and we'll get into that shortly, why would he have chosen this name? Did he know William Shakespeare of Stratford, or did he just pick a name out of a hat? Why this name?
Well, I think he just picked this as a pen name because of its classical connotations. The Greek goddess Athena was the goddess of culture and arts and so on, and she was typically portrayed shaking a spear. And the name Shakespeare is similar to other names that people took as nicknames, like Longbow or Strong Sword, names like that. And of course, William is just ordinary first name. I think the author picked that as a pseudonym, and eventually it became associated with Shakespeare of Stratford, who did travel to London and was part of the theatrical community. Now, whether they knew each other or not, it's hard to say. There were many fewer people in London, of course, at that time, and a lot of the families were interrelated. People tended to know almost everyone else in the business, as it were. So it's possible that he knew him, and it appears that in As You Like It, the playwright is making fun of Shakespeare of Stratford, making fun of his attempts to pass himself off as playwright.
Ah, so he may have been in on it. He may have known about it and played along?
It's possible. It's possible. It's just, we just don't have enough evidence
right.
to say one way or the other.
Right. But if that were the case, and people then bought into it, then William Shakespeare of Stratford would have been better known. He would have been, if he was going along with this ruse, people would have, if people bought into it, he would have been celebrated. People would have known about William Shakespeare. They would have attended his funeral, etc. The other thing that stands out is whoever wrote these plays had intimate knowledge of the royal court. They were very well traveled. Shakespeare writing about Italy and so forth. Is there any evidence that Shakespeare traveled outside of England?
No, there isn't. No. And there isn't any evidence that he was in a position to know what went on at court, much less satirize well-known nobles at court and get away with it. So it fit him at all.
All right, so the actual authorship question. It's obvious. It's the name of a fellowship, the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, and Oxford in this case is referring to whom?
Well, that's Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, born in 1550, and was. Became a ward of the crown when he was 12 years old in 1562 when his father died. This was the custom at that time, carrying over from feudal times. And so he grew up in London, became a courtier and an intimate of the queen, and he traveled, he learned languages, and he went to sea, he served in the military, and he corresponded with scientists and other scholars, and he was known as a patron of poets and playwrights. He employed two playwrights as his secretary, and a lot of his family appear in the Shakespeare plays. That's roughly the evidence for Oxford.
Right. And talk to me about the tradition of people associated with the court using aliases or nom de plumes. Why would they choose to do that? Why wouldn't he have published under his own name?
Well, at that time, the nobility was still living in the feudal age, and they did not indulge in commerce or in business or trying to earn money. They didn't publish what they wrote. When they wrote as a hobby or as a pastime. And they wrote, they produced manuscripts, and they passed them among themselves. The copies were made, and they were passed around. People responded to other people's manuscripts and so on. They were not interested in publishing. And to do so, people would have looked down on them. It was beneath the dignity of a nobleman to attempt to make money from any purpose except renting out and farming and exploring and so on, but engaging in commerce in the city, or publishing his work. It was not de rigueur.
Would it also have been considered telling tales out of school by those in the court, that here was an insider maybe taking gentle swipes or turns at satire of the Elizabethan court?
That's right. When they wrote about courts, there was the opportunity for satire, and that was another reason why the Queen and others would want Oxford to remain anonymous. Because if he weren't, then the people portrayed in his plays might be identified, because people knew that he knew who they were and what they were doing. So that was another reason why he remained anonymous.
Are there, I mean, I don't know how much is known about the 17th Earl of Oxford, how intimately we know him, but I'm wondering if there are clues in the sonnets, the plays, for example, a turn of phrase that Oxford was known to make that we see in, I don't know, Hamlet or some of the other works. Can you give me any examples?
Well, I don't know if I can give you specific examples, but there have been several studies done comparing the language and phrasing in his letters. We have dozens of letters of his, have nothing to do with the theater, but they are diplomatic letters or letters about business. Phrases and words in those that appear also in the Shakespeare plays. It's quite clear that a strong connection can be seen between his language and the language of Shakespeare. Yes.
I was also reading about an incident. There was there's a scene in Hamlet where they're describing a falling out between two tennis players, and apparently that incident occurred in Oxford's life as well. Do you remember that story at all?
Yes, in 1579, Oxford and Sir Philip Sidney had a squabble on one of the tennis courts in the palace, and they argued, and Oxford called Sidney a puppy, and Sidney stormed off and later challenged Oxford to a duel. The Queen intervened and told Sidney to back off, saying he had no business arguing with a nobleman. And tennis appears in several plays, and the word puppy appears in several plays. Oxford took a dislike to Sidney. Well, they disliked each other, of course, and he satirized him in a number of plays they're clearly digs at Sidney. So that's one incident, yes, that turns up in the plays.
More of my conversation with Ramon Jimenez on the Shakespeare authorship mystery when Conspiracy Unlimited continues.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Hey, if you're a fan of this podcast or my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, you're going to want to check out my brand new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet Shop. there's an exclusive line of men and women's classic tees with a very cool design. It's a limited run and a limited time offer, a special price of $21 US. That lasts only until August the 19th. There are also mugs, tote bags, and stickers. Go to strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca, and find the Strange Planet Shop button at the bottom of the page. The Strange Planet Shop at strangeplanet.ca.
The truth goes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Then, it is violently opposed. Finally, it is accepted as self-evident.
Let me just read that again. I don't know what that means.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Ramon Jimenez is here discussing the Shakespeare authorship question. Now, throughout history, there have been a number of people, famous people, actors, performers, who share this belief that Oxford, the Earl of Oxford, was in fact the author. Can we talk about some of those? I mean, let's start with Charlie Chaplin.
Yes, he was one. We were reminded of this I think, yesterday when John Paul Stevens died. John Paul Stevens was an Oxfordian.
A Supreme Court justice.
That's right. And there were three other justices. This matter was brought to them some years back. And they didn't really come to any conclusion except to say that, there was a reason to be interested in it, but they couldn't really rule or decide on who wrote the plays. But three or four of them showed that they were very much doubted Shakespeare of Stratford. Now, the most famous doubter is Mark Twain.
Hmm.
Mark Twain wrote an entire book on this subject called Is Shakespeare Dead?
Oh.
And he recounted how when he was learning to be a pilot on the Mississippi River, that the master of the ship who was training him was a doubter of Shakespeare, and talked at him at length while they were on the river about what a phony Shakespeare of Stratford was. Others have been Walt Whitman was sure that Shakespeare was not the author. Sigmund Freud was another one. John Galsworthy. There are a lot of them. Each one has a different reason for not believing. And the question is, should this issue be investigated? That's all we want, those of us who doubt Shakespeare. But the academics and the publishers and the universities say there is no question, there is no reason, there is no need to discuss this issue. There is no issue, so they won't talk about it.
Yes,
they won't debate it.
It's strange how the authorship question, as you say, is met by academia with derision, condescension, dismissiveness, and yet, on the face of it, it seems to be, as I mentioned earlier, a slam dunk case. I don't see how anyone could argue against. So, what is it? What is the threat here? Is it tenure? What is going on?
Well, that's part of it, I'm sure. But there's even more. I mean, here are these people have been taught that Shakespeare was the author. They are now being paid to teach that Shakespeare is the author. And so for those two reasons, they're not going to give that up. It's their reputation and their livelihood and their training from childhood. I mean, we've all been trained from childhood in this. And so there are very few, or occasionally an academic, usually someone who is not in the literature field, maybe a historian or a drama professor. We have lots of lawyers and scientists in the group who are doubters.
I just wanted to circle back to one of the doubters again, and that was Malcolm X, who I thought made a brilliant point, and that had to do with the King James Bible.
Well, I'm not familiar with that. What do you say?
Well, apparently King James had used poets, the greatest poets, to help him put together the King James Bible at that time. It would have been contemporaneous with Shakespeare, and yet Shakespeare was not invited to partake in the project.
Uh-huh. Well, yes, that's certainly true. In fact, we hear nothing about Shakespeare. You know, there's nothing in any record except these legal documents that involves him in writing in any way. Another point I'd like to make, no one in Stratford thought he was a writer. There were several writers in town. Folk Greville lived right outside of town. Michael Drayton was an exact contemporary of Shakespeare. He lived about 25 miles away, but he visited Shakespeare, Stratford, often. John Hall, Shakespeare's son-in-law, was a doctor.
Mm.
And for the last 10 years of Shakespeare's life, John Hall was the town doctor. And he kept a casebook of his more notable patients. And he wrote about them. He mentioned one had compiled a dictionary. He mentioned another one was a fine scholar, and so on and so forth. He had no entry for his father-in-law, much less anything to say about him. None of these people, Folk Greville, Michael Drayton, William Camden, knew the Shakespeare family. He was also familiar with the London stage and with poets and playwrights, never mentioned Shakespeare in anything he wrote. None of these people thought Shakespeare of Stratford had anything to do with writing. Even his descendants, no one ever claimed that he was the author. He never claimed he was the author. There's just no evidence for it.
Right. I mean, if your ancestor was the William Shakespeare, you'd have bragging rights. You'd be telling anyone who would listen, obviously. What about the town of Stratford itself? To what extent have they perhaps participated in this, let's call it a cover-up? Obviously, you know, that untold, you know, tourist dollars involved here. To what extent are they protecting this lie?
Oh, well, it's a full-scale effort. The Shakespeare Birthplace Trust is the official institution that is managing the alleged Shakespeare properties in Stratford-on-London. Of course, they run the festival and the town and so on. And no, none of them was willing to talk about this either. That would be a disaster for them if this were revealed.
Sure, killing the golden goose, to be sure.
Right.
And what about the Oxford, the descendants of the 17th Earl of Oxford? Is it possible that they have in their possession original manuscripts or knowledge that could blow this case wide open?
Well, if they did, they would bring them out. It's been, you know, 400 years, and so there are descendants, but and they're scattered all over the earldom. The earldom died a couple of years after the 17th Earl because there was no son, no one to inherit it. There was a second earldom created, but that had nothing to do with Shakespeare. No, there are no records in the Oxfordian descendants that no, they don't have anything. If they had, they would have brought it out a long time ago.
Do you believe that the present royal family, someone in the royal family, knows the ultimate truth?
No, I don't. Not unless they agree that it was Oxford, but I don't think they have any inside knowledge. No. In fact, I don't think anyone does today. have inside knowledge. We just have what we have read in books and manuscripts prepared by other people. None of us were there, of course.
So where do we go from here with this? What's the next step, if any?
Well, as I said, what we're trying to do is get a discussion going, because we're confident that once the academics decide to look into this with their resources and capacity for research and so on, they will quickly find more evidence that Oxford was the author. And so what we're trying to do is get the attention of a prominent Shakespeare scholar or two or three and turn them, as it were, so that their colleagues will be persuaded to at least take this up as a subject. We're not saying, you know, you have to stop teaching Shakespeare and begin teaching Oxford. We're saying, give us a chance to present our evidence. Let your young scholars do research in this field. That is taboo right now. No young professor or instructor at a university is going to get a degree or get very much attention, except the negative kind, if he tries to do research or publish something on the authorship question, except to deny it and deride it.
Well, to that end, to further the discussion and so forth, there will be a Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship conference coming up. Tell me about that. You'll be speaking there.
That will be in Hartford, Connecticut, this October. We have a conference every year. The Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship is an international organization of hundreds of people who believe that this research should be begun or conducted or continued. And so we gather once a year in a different place. The public is welcome. This year we are holding our meeting in the Mark Twain Center in Hartford, Connecticut. And we have several speakers on the Mark Twain connection. We have roughly 3 days of presentations, and we see a video or two and have interviews and debates and so on, trying to promote the idea that Oxford is the author and promote research, interest and research into this subject.
Again, that's the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference happening October 17th to the 20th at the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford, Connecticut. And for details and to register, people can go to ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org. ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org. Do you have a favorite Oxford play?
Well, yes, I think it's Henry V. That's what I've been working on. That was one that he rewrote, which brings up the subject of the book that I've just published, Shakespeare's Apprenticeship.
Yes.
This is a different approach to the authorship question. My premise in writing the book is that Oxford was the author, and I don't really argue that point any longer. I'm satisfied that he's the author. And so my research is focused on the next step, and that is, what else did he write? And what I have found is that there are five anonymous plays published during or just after Elizabeth's reign that have been ignored and are still deemed anonymous, but are actually Oxford's first versions of canonical plays.
Ah.
And they have titles such as King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is The Taming of a Shrew.
Mm-hmm.
And The Troublesome Reign of John, King of England. The True Tragedy of Richard III. And my favorite, which was his first, The Famous Victories of Henry V. And what Oxford did and what I demonstrate in my book is write these five plays during his teenage.
Wow.
He began writing very early, and we have some evidence for that. But as I say, these are anonymous. And his first play, The Famous Victories of Henry V, he wrote as a preteen. And 20 years later, he transformed that short, crude play of his teenage into the Prince Hal plays, the Henriad, Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and Henry V.
Yes.
And then the next year, he wrote The True Tragedy of Richard III, and 10 years later, transformed that, rewrote it, but used the same characters and roughly the same plot, and that is Richard III that we see today on the stage. He did the same thing with the next one, The Troublesome Reign of John. He used the same characters and the same plot, rewrote it entirely, and that is King John that we see today. The Shrew play, the same pattern. And then finally, he wrote a romance called King Lear in his late teens. And 30 years later, when his outlook had changed dramatically, he turned that into the tragedy we have of King Lear.
Right. And is there a similarity in writing style that would connect the anonymous works with later works of Oxford?
There are similarities in writing, but as I say, they were completely rewritten. We see certain phrases repeated, and certain rhetorical tricks or rhetorical techniques. But the real giveaway is the plot and the characters. In some of these revisions, the characters have the same names.
What is...
And, what? And the plots are very similar also.
Right, right. I mean, what does academia do with that information?
Oh, they say that, well, that's a source play. Shakespeare read that play, and that gave him the idea for King Lear.
So they're arguing that he was a
plagiarist.
A plagiarist.
That's right. Of course, in the history plays, he used the same historical characters, but he used the same fictional characters and the same fictional incidents that appeared in the earlier play, and he reused it in the canonical play. But these plays are inferior.
Sure. He was a preteen. He was
right,
a teenager.
Right.
Right.
And so that's the reason that the Orthodox scholars say that they're not by Shakespeare. Also, there's some evidence. There's not much evidence for their dates because they were not recorded and they were not printed and so on. But the dates tend to disfavor the dates of Shakespeare of Stratford. For instance, I think Famous Victories was written in 1563, which is a year before Shakespeare was born.
Aha! Uh-huh. This might be the smoking gun.
But I can't prove it. At least I can demonstrate it. I can bring out evidence. But it all depends on Oxford and on an acceptance of this kind of evidence. The academic scholars just think these plays are too bad and too early to be by Shakespeare Stratford, and that's why they reject them. But as anyone can see reading my book, in fact, you don't even have to read the book. If you read the introduction, there's enough material in there to demonstrate that these are Shakespeare's earliest plays.
Methinks there is a conspiracy afoot.
Well, you know, they accuse us of being conspiracy theorists, but the conspiracy is that done by the Orthodox scholars. They have banded together to conceal the real author and to ridicule those who try to expose him. That's a conspiracy.
Indeed. How do people get a hold of a copy of Shakespeare's Apprenticeship?
Well, it's available through the usual channels. It's published by Macfarlane in North Carolina, but it's available on any of the online or through any bookstore. It was published last September.
All right. And again, we have the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference happening October 17th to the 20th at the Mark Twain Museum in Connecticut. And people can go to ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org to register. Ramon, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for this.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm delighted. And thank you.
Okay, before I say goodnight to the moon over Messenia, I'll be back to tell you a little bit about the next installment of Conspiracy Unlimited. If you're a fan of this podcast, or my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, or my YouTube channel, Strange Planet, I hope you'll consider becoming an official donor. A donation of $50 a month places you in the Star Chamber. $20 a month is the whistleblower tier, and a donation of just $10 per month makes you a truth seeker. Star Chamber and Whistleblower members can participate in an exclusive monthly online chat or video conference with me. And all donors are entered into a monthly draw for Strange Planet merchandise. Any monthly amount is welcome and greatly appreciated. To become an official donor, go to patreon.com/strangeplanet. patreon.com/strangeplanet. Coming up on episode 263, the dangers of 5G.
At that time, the EPA was warned in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency, and they started accounting for non-ionizing radiation. And at that exact time, the FCC came in and said, no, we're going to be in charge of that. Don't worry, we'll be in charge of non-ionizing radiation. And so this cumulative radiation that's around us in our Wi-Fi tech and all this other stuff and in the Internet of Things, it will be drastically increased with 5G, at least 10 times more non-ionizing radiation than we now have.
Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now. Kelenikta.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need... We need constant petting.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.